Welcome, everybody. Been a great response to this this meeting this evening. Just to introduce myself, Crandall Williams. I edit Media North, Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom North, and we run regular meetings. If you want to look at what we do with Media North, all you need to do is Google Media North, one word, and it'll take you to our website. And if you want to get the magazine regularly as we do it, you just simply go onto our mailing list, contact us at cpbfnorth@outlook.com. Okay, that's the promotional business over with. Sincere welcome to the meeting. The reason for calling the meeting was that earlier this month, Eileen was involved in the very important hearings to do with the Shrewsbury 24 campaign. And I thought it was timely to have a public meeting which looked at the broad issue about miscarriages of justice, the ways in which, for most of the media, this is a silent issue, the inquiry and everything else. Mm-hmm. If you look in newspapers, with rare exceptions, Rob Evans in The Guardian does some good work. The Morning Star's covers, with its limited resources, it covers these issues. But this evening, what I wanted to try and do, and we've got three great speakers, I wanted to start off with Stephen Dorrell. Steve Dorrell has written lots of books about the security services. He's written an excellent book called Smear, which is about Harold Wilson and the way the security services seek to demolish, in a way, his reputation. And so we're going to start off with Steve. So over to you, Steve Dorrell, please.
Oh, hi. Hi, everybody. I'm going to try and pack as much as I can in a very short space of time. Hopefully we'll come to the questions that can answer more about it. Directly, I'll go to the question that was posed. Why has so much energy and resources been devoted to targeting trade unionists in undercover operations? The quick and easy answer to that is the middle class wanted it. Now, it's a very complex answer after that, and I'll try and explain why. But for me, there are two key dates, two key years in the context of the attack on trade unionists. The first is 1968, the year of revolutions. This is the beginnings of the special demonstration squad from the Metropolitan Special Branch, which began infiltration of student groups, political groups, and eventually trade union groups as well. And 1968, in terms of security, is a very odd year. Lots of unexplained events happened, which to this day, not clear who did them and why and how. There were forgeries. There was a great deal of infiltration. There were agent provocateur activities. There were even bombings, shootings. Posters appeared from nowhere. New groups appeared. No one knows who they were. And this is the time when Peter Wright said MI5 were very, very active. And I believe that they were. There's a new book come out. It's a biography of a MI5 officer called Nicholas Reeve. And I'll just quote something from it. As far as the last Grosvenor Square demo is concerned, it was a Maoist breakaway in October 27th, 1968. On behalf of the Vietnam Solidarity Campaign, I had asked for a show of strength on that day and not a test of strength. This is from Tariq Ali. For weeks previously, the government had spread black propaganda. Violence was being planned and the MOD might be attacked and occupied, etc. A tiny Maoist group, probably led by a chief inspector, went to Grosvenor Square, engaged in a punch-up and ended up playing cops football. It did, even at the time, seem like a provocation. Well, the MI5 officer says, there was a lot of subversion in this country at that time. There was an enormous number of organizations who were against the Vietnam War and were trying to overthrow the government. It was really quite ludicrous to see the way these people behaved, saying they would stop the Vietnam War. An absolute group of rabble-rousers round the American embassy when you had the whole panoply of the British government and armed forces who were supporting the Americans. says, what was particularly interesting was that we managed to infiltrate. This is the MI5 officer. I used to go to some of their meetings and wave the flag and say, up the anti-Vietnam group, etc. This was terribly amusing because the final demonstration to Grosvenor Square was led by one of the chief superintendents of Special Branch, and they didn't know it. So we were in complete control of the whole thing, but nobody went to prison. Nobody was investigated unnecessarily, and the whole thing was under control. So MI5 were engaged. Special Branch, Metropolitan Special Branch, didn't really have a clue of what was going on themselves. MI5 was a very bureaucratic organization up until 1968, which relied on membership of the Communist Party of Great Britain for its files. If your grandmother had been a member of the party, that was enough for you to have a file in MI5. And there were thousands upon thousands of files. But they didn't know what Maoist groups were. They didn't know what the IMG were. They didn't know what the TROP groups were. An amusing incident, one of the leading Special Branch people who was investigating these groups went to Stuart Christie of the Anarchist Black Cross. Unfortunately, Stuart died last year. He told me that the Special Branch officer in 1968 said, Stuart, tell me, who are these Maoists? You know, what have they got to do with the Communist Party? Are TROPs communists? And they didn't know. And he had to tell them and gave them a political lecture about all the different groups. And from that point on, the Special Branch began to collect files and infiltrate the groups. And gradually this moved into trade union groups. Now, in the 1980s, during the miners' strike, I was asked to give talks to various trade union groups during the strike and later. And I actually played down the degree of infiltration because it became very clear that the trade unions were very naive. They didn't really understand the level, the scope of this kind of infiltration. And when I did mention it, people laughed. If I was in the room, I'd say, is this room been debugged? And they would laugh. If I said, have you swept the room or have you looked at the telephones? Because they'd all be tapped. They just simply did not believe it. But it did happen. In the early 1970s, Special Branch recruited hundreds of trade unionists and built up files. Some of them did it for patriotic reasons, apparently. Some were paid and some became agents. Now, this was so successful that MI5 became very jealous. And they decided that they would move in on this and take it over. Much to the chagrin of the Special Branch, who, in their eyes, had done a hugely successful campaign. Part of this was they wanted to get to Ted Heath and try and persuade him to take the whole issue seriously. And I believe that they used Lord Rothschild, who was Heath's main political and intelligence advisor on this. He told Heath about what he saw as a serious problem of subversion in the country and of the subversion of trade unions. And Heath, at the time of the kind of U-turn on economics, went along with this and decided to allow the Information Research Department, IRD, which was a semi-covert Foreign Office propaganda unit, to give information to industry and to individuals and to journalists. And so for the first time, really, a great deal of information about trade unions and left groups, the far and wide left, was given to organizations like IRIS, Common Cause, who were heavily involved in anti-trade union activities. Now, IRD had begun in the late 40s. It was created by Bevan and the Labour government as an anti-communist unit. But in the 1960s, it changed. Communism, in their eyes, was on the decline, and the Communist Party, in the eyes of MI5, was no longer a serious threat at all. They knew the identities of almost all members. They knew the money that was raised, they knew where it came from, they knew the conduits for this, and they realized it wasn't a threat. And they changed towards counter-subversion. And a part of this was the take-up, and the files have only come out in the last 6 months or so, of what's called Special Political Action, SPA. Normally, this was carried out by MI6, the Foreign Intelligence Agency, abroad. But for the first time, Special Political Action took place domestically. This is a huge, huge political shift of using psychological warfare against your own domestic population. SPA involves the use of, in MI6 terms, forgeries, recruiting journalists, agents, infiltration, agent provocateur activities, whole list of things that they were doing abroad, but now we're importing domestically and in Northern Ireland. So this was a major change, and officials normally, Home Office that has control of Special Branch and MI5, do not like this. They want to retain control of it and not see this used by what they would regard as outsiders and amateurs. So this was quite a big move. Now, the other part of this, I think, is 1973. This, in the eyes of myself and some economic historians, is really the key year since the Second World War in terms of the economy. The oil crisis changed everything.
19 hours.
And part of what happened was there was quite a big backlash from the middle classes. The post bags of Conservative MPs were full of letters complaining about the fact that their salaries, pensions, savings were going down. And they blamed this largely on the trade unions. The trade unions in the late 50s and 60s had done very well. They'd increased the paying conditions of workers, and the differential between the working class and the middle class was closing. This was a time, and the last time, of social mobility. And the Conservative MPs were getting in the net, basically, that if they didn't do something about it, then they would lose their seats. And in reality, you can argue that the economy has never recovered since then. Wages have remained low, and industry decided that this was going to happen. Now, in Germany, they carried on with their system of corporate boards, local banks, etc., which ironically had been set up by the British post-war. But in the UK and America, the decision was basically taken by industry and business that if they wanted to keep their profits, then they had to cut. It's very stark looking at the figures. The fall in research and development since then and now is big. Similarly, the number of entrepreneurs, and this might sound counterintuitive, has fallen greatly. But the area they chose to attack most was on wages. And to do this, you have to attack the trade unions. And it's very clear from reading the memoirs of the time, the records of the time, that the Conservatives, and particularly that group around which became the Thatcherites, were going to attack the trade unions. And they did. So the recruitment by Special Branch was increased, and MI5 became directly involved in this and took over the whole campaign. And throughout the 70s, you saw this increase in counter-subversion and actions against trade unions. A sign of this is in 1975, a group of Tory MPs who would basically become the first cabinet of Mrs. Thatcher's government had a meeting with Sir Robert Armstrong, who was the permanent secretary of the Home Office, but would become cabinet secretary in Mrs. Thatcher's government. And they wanted to know what the government was doing in the light of the miners' strike about combating trade unions. Armstrong said, just don't worry. It's all in hand. We've got it organized. And they did, and they had. And I think that's basically what happened, is it was a political decision, it was a change in the economics, and it was a huge increase in surveillance and recruitment amongst the trade unions. And we saw the results of that eventually with the miners' strike, which was heavily defeated and in some ways was almost inevitable. And as a result of that, I think from 73 onwards, the economy has continued to decline, and it may be a permanent decline. I'll leave it there for a moment.
Okay, well, that's great. Thanks ever so much for getting us started, Steve. There's some chilling examples you were giving there as well about the way in which the security services operated. And you mentioned the year 73, which, of course, was also the year that the first Shrewsbury trial began later in that year after the building workers' strike of 72. And that leads very neatly on to Eileen Turnbull. Now, Eileen is the researcher for the Shrewsbury 24 campaign and has done some great work in digging up some of the stuff. You mentioned IRD, and I'm not going to steal Eileen's thunder. I'm going to hand over to Eileen now so she can talk a little bit about one of the groups trying to challenge and overturn miscarriage of justice. There's a long list: Augury Truth and Justice Campaign, the Spy Cops Group, the Blacklist Support Group, and so on. And so over to you, Eileen.
First of all, thank you very much for inviting me to contribute to this event tonight. Just a couple of points, Granville, of clarification to begin with. The flyer for this event refers to the recent judicial review of the original trials of the pickets in 73 and 74. I'm absolutely happy to tell you the judicial review was actually 2 years ago. And after 47 years, I'm now delighted to tell you we've actually got the case back to the Court of Appeal. It was actually heard on the 3rd and the 4th of February. And the judges, as we speak, have reserved their judgment, and we are currently awaiting the outcome of the Court of Appeal case. So that's just a sort of little point of clarification. Now, the Shrewsbury 24 campaign was set up in 2006 in response to the premature death of the leading picket, Des Warren, 2 years earlier. Des received the heaviest sentence of all the pickets. He received 3 years in prison. And he actually tells the full story of that in his book, The Key to My Cell. We have worked closely with the pickets now for 15 years. And our aim is always to have the convictions of all the pickets, all the 24, quashed. They arose from the first and only national building workers' strike in 1972. At the end of the three trials in Shrewsbury Crown Court, six trade unionists were in prison for picketing. 16 got suspended sentences. The pickets have always maintained that this was a miscarriage of justice. We knew in 2006 there was only one path along which our campaign could go to get the pickets' convictions quashed. We had to persuade the Criminal Cases Review Commission to use its statutory powers to refer the convictions to the Court of Appeal. And this is no easy task. Ask any miscarriage of justice campaigner. As illustration, in 2019 to 2020, the CCRC received, and I'm going to make this very clear, 1,334 applications. In the same year, it sent just 29 cases to the Court of Appeal, and that's around 2%. And that's not a one-off. That's since the inception of the CCRC. The CCRC will only refer the pickets' convictions if we obtained fresh evidence, and that was not available for the original trials in 73 and 74. As a campaign committee member, I carried out extensive research over a period of 10 years to find that evidence. We lodged the pickets' applications to the CCRC in 2012, and 5 years later, in 2017, they were turned down. But we never gave up. We then went on to challenge the CCRC's decision by way of a judicial review. We argued that its decision was perverse and that the CCRC had not understood the correct legal test to apply to the evidence we provided. At the hearing in the Administrative Court in Birmingham in 2019, our barrister, Danny Friedman of Matrix Chambers, put our case. And believe it or not, after 2 hours, the CCRC, after all those years, threw in the towel. We were absolutely jubilant. We were over the moon. But it took them a further 10 months to accept our fresh evidence and agree to send the case to the Court of Appeal. Now, I'd like to look at how was the fresh evidence discovered? Because the obstacles were huge. Our starting point in 2007 was naturally to ask the Labour government to release all the documents relating to the Shrewsbury trials in 73 and 74. And in reply, we were told that the documents were being held back under Section 23 of the Freedom of Information Act, that to release them to us would be a threat to national security. We've not to forget here, this is the Labour government. We didn't accept this. What was so secretive about a national building workers strike 40 years earlier? So we campaigned for the release of the papers. We gathered over 100,000 signatures on an e-petition and a paper petition. And this activity generated widespread interest in the case. It then led to a debate in Parliament, championed by, I have to say, a brilliant person called David Anderson, then the Labour MP for Gateshead. And they voted in Parliament 120-3 to release all the documents. And what happened? Yes, you've guessed it. No further information has been released at all. Now, I knew then, and I have to say I had to face it, I was really up against it. So I decided to try and find the evidence myself. I travelled the length and breadth of the country to various archives. I think I kept the last count, it was 21. Cross-referencing documents as I went along. What is before the Court of Appeal at the minute is just a fraction of the information I managed to obtain about the trials, as the CCRC and the Court of Appeal are only concerned with the evidence which deals with the legal issues surrounding the Pickett's trials and convictions. For those who are interested in the whole story, I have written a book about the case, and it's a fascinating story, which includes the role of the employers, the police, the prosecution, and the judiciary. And hopefully it should be published later in the year. Our Court of Appeal case has two grounds, which together we have argued denied the Picketts the right to a fair trial. And that's so important, a fair trial, because that's what we stand by, or so we should in this country, a fair trial. But there are grounds in which, as I said before, we've argued which denied the Picketts the right to a fair trial. Firstly, in 2012, I discovered a DPP file about the trials in the National Archives, Q. The file was large and I copied the entire contents so that I could read all the documents back at home in Liverpool. But skimming through it in the reading room in Q, I spotted a particular document that I knew straight away was vital evidence. It was a note of a conference 3 weeks before the trial began on the 3rd of October 1973. The conference involved the lead prosecutor, Maurice Drake QC, the DPP and the police. Fortunately for us today, the junior counsel, Desmond Fennell, he couldn't attend the conference. And so Superintendent Glover, bless him, wrote him a letter enclosing a two-page summary headed "Matters discussed with Mr. Drake." Couldn't be any clearer. Paragraph 16 of that document reads, "So that counsel would be aware, it was mentioned that not all original handwritten statements were still in existence, some having been destroyed after a fresh statement had been obtained. In most cases, the first statement was taken before photographs were available for witnesses and before the officers taking the statements knew what they were trying to prove. It goes without saying, police should not destroy original handwritten statements. If prosecution counsel are told this, they have a duty to inform the defence and the court. They didn't do this. What's so important about original statements? They are a person's first recollections of an event when their memory is most reliable. If they make a later one that contradicts the first, it allows the defence to question them about the inconsistencies. But if you don't know about an earlier statement or those statements have been destroyed, you're kept in the dark. Now, the second ground of our appeal was also based upon evidence that I obtained from Q. Though it needed an FOI request from me to get it released to the National Archives. I had already discovered that a film was broadcast on ITV halfway through the first trial on the 13th of November, 1973. It was called Red Under the Bed. The Pickett's lawyers at the time had made an application for the makers, Anglia TV, and the wonderful Woodrow Wyatt to be held in contempt of court. Although the judge ordered the production of the film to the court and watched it in chambers, he dismissed the application and no more was heard of it. The Cabinet Office file that I obtained in 2013 is called Woodrow Wyatt's TV Programme Red Under the Bed. It showed that the government, through the Foreign Office's Information Research Department, that department again, was heavily involved in the film, providing documents and witnesses for Wyatt to use. The film showed the building workers' strike, footage of building sites which had walls and windows damaged. It also showed scenes of police lines outside Shrewsbury Crown Court and footage of the pickets leading a demonstration in Shrewsbury on the day that all 24 pickets appeared in the magistrates' court in March 1973. I also discovered a film. I also discovered a film of a studio discussion of the documentary, which was broadcast immediately afterwards in several ITV regions, including ATV, which covered Shrewsbury. A number of highly prejudicial comments were made during the discussion. In the Cabinet Office file was a comment that Wyatt was able to make a number of points during the studio discussion that the IBA had required him to remove from his narrative in the documentary before they would approve it for transmission. An important part of this, which is relevant to the theme of this Zoom meeting, is that the role of a journalist called Simon Regan. He had written an article as part of a two-page spread in the News of the World in October 1972. He made lurid claims that he had posed as a striking building worker and when picketing with them in the summer, witnessing intimidation, violence and damage to property. I found documents at Q that showed the articles were seen by the Attorney General, who asked the DPP to make inquiries. The DPP wrote to several police forces for reports into Regan's claims. And, believe it or not, I found these reports, notably from Northampton and the City of Birmingham police forces. And in a nutshell, both reports said that Regan was telling a pack of lies. And yet he was interviewed several months later on camera for Wyatt's Red Under the Bed film, repeating his discredited claims about violent picketing on building sites. This information about the Red Under the Bed was put on our website shortly after I discovered it, and it was covered in several national newspapers. There is a lot more to be said about this file, a lot more, but I don't have the time. What I've learned from my research, which has taken me a long time, admittedly, because I was never a researcher, is the need for patience and perseverance. And, you know, a great supporter of our campaign, Ken Loach, he said to me that the truth will always get out eventually. You have to keep digging and you have to keep demanding. I sincerely hope from the bottom of my heart that the information that I have dug up will bring justice for the pickets. And as I said at the beginning, we are waiting for the decision of the Court of Appeal. Please check out our website, the Shrewsbury 24 campaign, for details. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to get the latest news. And can I thank you all for listening or watching me this evening? Thank you.
Well, that was, thanks ever so much, Eileen. I mean, that was inspirational. I mean, and the efforts and energy that you put into uncovering that, it reminds me in a way of what the Hillsborough people did, that they had to go and dig and dig and dig to get the evidence to confront the lies that had been said about who was responsible for the disaster. Tremendous stuff there. Thanks very much, Eileen. One of the things that you mentioned, Eileen, was the Red Under the Bed program.
Yes.
And that the IBA, and Laurie will know this, the IBA used to look at programs before they went on air. Now, often they were the ones like the Granada World in Action programs that they didn't like because they were criticised from a left perspective sometimes. But Red Under the Bed, they didn't like. They thought it was too right-wing. What Wyatt was doing was actually presenting his own view. So I'm interested in what you said, that in the discussion afterwards, even though he complained he was censored, he wrote a letter to the Times saying he was censored for the programme. So I'm interested in what you said there. Okay, we're moving on now to Laurie Flynn. I've already mentioned Laurie, and Laurie also, historically, of course, covered the original trial. So he's got an intimate knowledge of what happened at Shrewsbury back there in 73 and 4. So, Laurie, over to you.
Okay, the first thing I need to say is I need to make it loud and clear that people like me come in the wake of a host of campaigns of people who don't think democracy is dead, who don't think justice is dead, who don't accept injustice. And for me, Steve Dorrell's book Smear about the treatment of Harold Wilson is one of the most disturbing and inspirational books I've read in many years. Furthermore, it goes along with another book that I find disturbing and inspirational, Empire of Secrets by Calder Walton. Along with these inspirations of people who research things, I would place very, very highly Eileen and Mark Turnbull's work, their persistence in digging and digging and digging and not giving up. But also, let's patch in all the other campaigns, Orgreave, Hillsborough, Shrewsbury, the Scots miners who have now got their charges quashed. What about Grenfell Tower? What about Hillsborough? What about the Lawrence family? What about Duane Brooks? What about Windrush? What about all the campaigns I don't know about? We are actually in the middle of a failing state, a state that is extremely well developed at covering things up. It likes to cover things up. It likes to delay and deny until you die. And of course, Des Warren did die. He was left hanging, imprisoned, perturbed, drugged. And these are deeply, deeply shocking things, which are all indicative not only of an ailing state, but an imperial state that is dying, that has spent a lot of time dying, a lot of time covering things up. And one of the campaigns I would like to mention is the campaign of the Mau Mau victims in Kenya, or Kenya, I don't even know how to pronounce it properly. But these people uncovered the fact that there were 1,500 files hidden away in a place called Hanslope Park in Milton Keynes. I hope that's the right pronunciation of Keynes or Keynes. I don't know, but it'll have to do. So what we have here is an entire building, a vast building, not a garden shed, but a vast building where thousands and thousands of files about what Britain did in its imperial past that have been secreted away and are still secreted away. And until there is a proper openness about all this, we will carry on having scandal after scandal, after scandal after scandal. How appalling is the Windrush scandal? How appalling is the Grenfell Tower scandal? How appalling is it that anybody who campaigns about anything is deemed a subversive? And before I turn to what small things I have to say about my own experience of trying to cover some of these stories, I'd just like to say that this period from 1970 or 1968 onwards is the period where military-industrial complex capitalism and its scientific allies are busy polluting the planet as never before, subverting the very possibilities of human life. And all the special branch and the police can do is chase after a load of wee campaigners fighting for a pound an hour in the 1972 building workers' strike. I was arrested as a reporter watching what went on in Birmingham during that strike. I was found not guilty eventually after a few months of torment. Nothing like all the pickets have experienced, 40-odd years of torment. This is how terrible this is. This is how tyrannical bits of lawlessness are woven into the so-called democratic state, which is very, very far from democratic in all sorts of ways. I first came across people watching me and others when I was a young cub reporter at Construction News in 1969 and 1970, when we first came across the McAlpines' tremendous ability to get contracts, even though they weren't the lowest bidders, because they were so closely aligned with the military-industrial complex and the British state. They were able to get the contract to build BSC, British Steel Corporation's Anchor Steelworks, even though they were far from the lowest bidder. They were able to get all sorts of other contracts, and they were also able to be among the people who trampled on the building workers in the 1972 strike and who arranged for horrible things to happen, not in Liverpool, not in Birmingham, but in North Wales, where the trade union and labour movement was very weak. And there's no doubt whatsoever that this was a strategic decision taken to victimise people, to put people on trial who should never have been put on trial. Indeed, the local police forces have concluded that there was trouble on both sides and the cases should not go ahead. But we're dealing with 1968, the great demonstrations against the Vietnam War, and some people, demented people, and people who really hanker after a past that is long gone, a past that involved making money from slavery, making money from gold mines in southern Africa, making money from Rhodesia, where the land was stolen by Rhodes and his friends from the African people, making money in the Democratic Republic of Congo, or the Congo as it used to be called. You're dealing with people who really believe that what they had in that period was the ultimate summa of civilization. Now, actually, it was racist, it was exploitative, it was unpleasant and horrible. But for them, it brought them land, it brought them money, it brought them treasures, some of which they stole, including the treasures from the Parthenon. And it's in that milieu that one must locate the arrival of the Thatcher government and its profoundly reactionary and horrible behaviour. So what happened to the steel workers and then the miners and then the workers at Wapping were not unconnected. They were not random accidents. In each of these disputes, in almost every form of radical protest in Britain, you have the police, the special police, the secret police, and their allies at work. What happened to me, we were spied on at Construction News in 1969 and 1970, and the editor of the little paper I worked for, one of the most profitable papers in British history, Construction News, was got rid of because he would not stop publishing difficult stories about the realities of the construction industry. So after that, I worked for the Socialist Worker for a while, for a good while. And there I was able to expose the fact that the Vesti company had secretly contrived to cheat the dock workers out of their jobs and create a new company, Midland Cold Storage, where they were then arrested for picketing and put in jail. And I was able to show that they had fiddled all this and lied to the company registrars, had done this all through front companies, the usual repertoire of dishonesty that you get among major polluters and exploiters. Sometime after that, I had to leave the Socialist Worker because I didn't fancy being bossed around by somebody who seemed to think that toy Bolshevism was de rigueur and that it was a really good idea to boss people around. And I was lucky enough to go and work for World in Action for a while, for quite a long while. And there again, there were strange events. There were people who were put into the program who were dubious, dodgy, who were undermining things, causing fights and arguments. And it's my experience that eventually I left there and I went to work at The Guardian. And once again, strange events took place. We were investigating the background to the shameful murder of Stephen Lawrence, the role of corruption in that, the levels of corruption in the Metropolitan Police. And all of this was being covered up. And in order to prevent publication, the Commander Andy Heyman, one of the most disreputable senior officials of the Met, interfered behind the scenes and basically had us moved off the story. So what you have when you look into what happened in Britain in my lifetime, in our lifetime, is that Rupert Murdoch became the kingpin of the communications business. And he personally and his allies corrupted the Metropolitan Police and turned them into their own peons. He was even in a position where they were coaching the candidates for the commissioner. And the commissioner took his shillings, and out of the Wapping tragedy grew a closeness between Murdoch and the police and the British establishment that still, to a reduced degree after the hacking scandal, continues to this day. But we can be quite clear, Sky TV, if you had Sky TV, then Sky TV would be installing the bugs on behalf of the special branch. If you wanted to argue for proper wages and conditions for people who worked in the health services or worked as delivery drivers, you would be shat on by the Murdoch press. This was a disgraceful alliance. And this story, a huge story of how corrupt the relationship between the secret state, the official state, the Tory party, this is why there was no Leveson II, because there's a continual running line from 1968 onwards, from the great anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, that anybody who protests about almost anything is viewed as either a subversive or potentially subversive. And this is a disgraceful state of affairs. And its origins lie absolutely in Britain's imperial adventures and corruption in Ireland, in India, in the West Indies, in Southern Africa. And this cancer that is in our midst is something that right now they are trying to defend against those honourable people in the museums and in the universities who want to come to terms with Britain's imperial past. Mm-hmm. And until we do come to terms with that, we can be damn sure there'll be many, many more scandals of this kind, many more campaigns who are treated for years with procrastination, with denial of information. And this is just the British way. I'm sorry, and until we acknowledge this, until we build much, much bigger, freer, more generous alliances, this will be the continuing decline and decline and decline of a Britain that has never been modern, has never been really democratic, and is still run by an elite who don't want to be modern and don't want to be democratic.
Okay, thank you very much, Laurie. Some grim views there. Just one link between what you've just said and the Orgreave Truth and Justice campaign. It's the link between the empire and what the way in which policing during the miners' strike. Many of the issues about the training of the police, the short shield units, this was the transfer of an experience, of course, from policing in the empire to the British scene. Now, I'm at a disadvantage here because normally there's lots and lots of questions coming up and down on my screen, but I don't seem to have any. So I'm going to go over to Scott or Jason. Is there anybody signaling any questions that they'd like to ask? Either Steve, Laurie or Eileen. So over to...
I'll ask you on Granville. I hope so.
I'm going to just help him out here. There you go.
Okay.
I think my first...
Okay, Scott, you want to get going?
Yeah, cool. Just to anybody really on the panelists, my first comment is the integrity initiative. It seems to have got completely wiped under the, shoved under the carpet. And has anybody got any, with the Alex Salmond stuff, the treatment of Corbyn, the Manafort stuff in The Guardian, it was all linked to an integrity initiative. Has anybody got any information on that? Any comments on the integrity initiative?
Can I just say something, please?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, Eileen.
There's been two, I mean, you mentioned it earlier on, but there's been two articles in The Guardian about our campaign. One was last year, in 2020, when, as I said before, we were delighted when our case was referred to the Court of Appeal by the CCRC. An article went in then, and an article went in again on the second day of the Court of Appeal hearing this year. Both of those articles were misleading. And I wrote to The Guardian and explained courteously how they were misleading. And The Guardian, and I wrote twice, by the way, and they just totally disregarded it. And so, you see, I have got this, you can say negative vibes, call it what you want. But I think now newspapers are there just to sell popularity. And I've never known pickets in my life to be popular with anybody. And so therefore, I don't expect any newspaper to give us a fair crack of the whip. And I don't. And can I just say that our campaign from day one, what we've done is gone through the trade unions, and our campaign has got over 1,000 branches within trade unions affiliated to us. We've got 21 national unions affiliated to us, regions, the TUC supporters, because, you know, that's who matter. That's who matter. That's what's about. It's about power when you pick it. It's what, why do you pick it? You know, what is your problem? Where is your grievance? So, you see, I am now very reserved, if you like, about the national press, and I don't care which one it is. And I'm also reserved about the left-wing press, because they seem totally, if you like, obsessed with selling newspapers. And whatever sells the newspaper, they will print. So you can call me negative. You can say that, you know, whatever you wish. But that's the way I feel, because that's the experience that we've had.
Okay, thanks, Eileen. There's a question just coming up here from Arantxa. I hope I pronounced your name right. Do you have any advice for those who are currently involved in campaigns, apart from learning what Hillsborough Orgreave have done, to avoid, protect yourself against infiltration agitation? Maybe that's one for you, Steve.
Oh, God, this has been a problem since 1968, how to avoid infiltration. I'll give you a story to illustrate to what levels this goes to. I used to run a magazine called Lobster with another person. So there were only two people involved in this. One was in Hull and I was in Leamington Spa. And I had it from a very, very good source connected to MI5 that we had been infiltrated. How is it possible to infiltrate a group of two? I knew it wasn't me, and I trusted the other person, and the other person, Robin, said it wasn't him. So who was it? About a year later, we discovered what had actually happened. Robin, who lived in Hull, used to like to go jogging. And when he went jogging, he went along with a lecturer from Hull University. And they got to know each other. And it turned out it was him. Wow. After a time, because Robin got a kind of inkling this might be the case, and he asked him about it. And about another year later, he told him. He said when he'd been at Oxford, Sir Isaiah Berlin had recruited him. Berlin is very close to MI6, recruited him, and this guy was going up to Hull to be a lecturer, and he said, well, when you're up there, can you keep an eye on this left-wing magazine called Lobster? And that's what happened. So, when infiltration is at that kind of level, what do you do? To be honest, you have to go on instinct, and I know a number of left groups have kind of isolated themselves, used to give kind of questionnaires to new entrants to see what Marxism was or whatever. So it's very difficult to do. I think it's probably somebody who hangs around. It's somebody who wants to go to all the meetings. It's somebody who wants to push you a bit further than you want to go. I think you have to have a certain amount of suspicion. But I think the other side of this is to be completely open. all the political groups I was in were just completely open. We did not have secrets. And so if they wanted to know what we were doing, you basically told them. So the effect of infiltration was kind of just cancelled. And so I think that's what you have to do, is just be open about everything you do.
Right. Now, Nigel, did you want to ask a question? Nigel Varley.
I'll just say my piece. I mean, I've been around for, well, in politics since 1963, 64. I was on the Grosvenor Square demo. I've seen the operation of the ruling class, well, still going on from the... I mean, I was in the International Socialists, which is now the Socialist Workers' Party, and a couple of old comrades here from a long time ago. And I saw Liverpool IS wrecked from the inside. One of the tactics is splitting and wrecking by turning members against each other on what seemed to be meaningless personal disputes. They also nobbled leading members. I mean, Roger Rosal was a classic case, a very important member of Liverpool IS who was bought off. But the other thing I'm seeing recently in my work in the National Education Union, which was the NUT, is the way that they're not police agents and they're not MI5 agents, but they're people who are obviously working for the other side. They get into position and they sit on things. We've had a case now recently where people have been agitating for a much stronger resistance by the union to the premature opening of schools. And there are key people who are just in offices who sit on it, who agree with you, don't argue with you, but then don't do anything. So the way they operate, I've seen it time and time again, both in politics and in the union, is splitting and wrecking. And if you look, the way it's going on is if somebody's factionalizing or raising, you look at what are they doing? What are they arguing on? Does it really mean anything politically? And if it doesn't have any basis, then it's wrecking. And you also look for people who suddenly come from nowhere, get into key positions, and the key position is branch secretaryship in a union, and just sit on it and don't do anything. They don't argue. They don't put forward a right-wing agenda. They just sit on it. And the answer to that is to build the movement, build a rank and file movement, so you've got the strength to overturn this and carry on fighting. But I could go on for ages about stories about splitters, wreckers, police, spies, agents, provocateurs.
Okay.
I mean, Gravel and Laurie, old comrades, are probably.
I think I want to stand back a little bit from getting into the more conspiratorial aspects and just go back. Laurie, when you worked on World in Action, one of the things that Eileen was saying that she now doesn't trust the newspapers, the media, but I do think that there have been glimpses where we've seen, I don't think we're going to get many more of them, but where we've seen the broadcast media, in particular current affairs programs. First Tuesday with Grant McKee pursued miscarriages of justice for the Guildford Four and similarly, I remember very much the issue in Birmingham. Sorry, the Birmingham Six, the miscarriage of justice. And it was a Granada World in Action program that first said the forensics is flawed and the Birmingham Six were beaten up. That's how they were treated. And so, Laurie, I mean, you described some negative experiences, but what about that experience with the Granada World in Action? Was it anything positive about it at all, apart from that example I've given?
Oh, it's hugely positive. But it was hugely positive because Granada was a unequivocally evidence-driven, left-wing, socialist intervention into the communications jungle. In a sense, it was the replacement for the Daily Herald and the News Chronicle. It was founded by a man and his brother, the Bernstein family, who were remarkably cultured, capable entrepreneurs, business people, but who were people who had a profound sense of the appalling crisis that so-called civilization was going through in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. And out of the war, I mean, the first thing that Sidney Bernstein tried to do after the war with his friend Alfred Hitchcock was to produce a film about Keir Hardie, the founder of the Scottish Labour Party and the person who enabled Labour to have some purchase on the appalling nature of capitalism at that time. I mean, you're talking about a culture that was deliberately destroyed, that was put to the sword by the kind of political legislation that was brought in, not only to destroy World in Action, but to destroy This Week, to destroy Roger Bolton, to take out Yorkshire TV, yeah, to take out Weekend World, to take out the Friday night programme that Thames put on. You're talking about a huge landslide of tyrannical proportions. Yes, there are many. Let's also just deal with The Guardian for a minute.
Okay.
The Guardian has more than one side to it. There are some wonderful, wonderful people work there. Not all of them work there anymore. But the undercover policing inquiry is something that we need to say is a very serious achievement. Quite what the outcome will be is another question, because it's being delayed and delayed partly by the illness and I think death of the original judge and his replacement by the latest guy, who's quite a lot safer from what I hear. But that inquiry would not have come about without two things. The campaigners, and it's a grave admission on my part that I didn't mention the women who stood up and campaigned about the way they had been wronged, raped, misused, and deliberately exploited by the Metropolitan Police. This is a huge scandal. And it to me, it is quite appalling that this inquiry is dribbling away into the sands and not dealing and bringing out into the open what really happened here. This is a truly shameful event that these women were sincere, dissident, campaigning people who were set upon by the high command. There's no doubt about this. This was not something that was improvised by rank-and-file officers. This was driven right from the top. And it is, in Italy, there's a thing called the cupboard of shame. Well, we've dealt with some of the components of of the British cupboard of shame. But high among them would be the treatment of these women and the treatment of two Irish solicitors who were murdered. Rosemary Nelson, Pat Finucane. These are huge, massive scandals of world-class importance, which are quietly being procrastinated, buried, parked away in buildings, in files. And until, I mean, the problem is the control of the commercial media is so powerful and the fear in the public sector of the BBC is so palpable that you are no longer getting any irritants from places like World in Action or Granada. Granada doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Its traditions were blown to the wind deliberately and deliberately destroyed.
Thanks for that. Now, I'm conscious that we normally run this event for about an hour. So I'm going to hand back to Scott and just ask him, Scott, are there any more questions bubbling up out there that we need to ask?
Are you there? Granville, there's one in the chat from Simon Williams.
All right. Okay. Okay. Stephen, How close were we to GB75, a similar right-wing group undertaking direct action in the UK? Also, does the actions of 68 onwards fit into a wider European strategy of tension to discredit left-wing groups? That's a long one.
The big conspiracy. I've often wondered about the events of 1968, whether they did fit into what's known as the strategy of tension, because it certainly seems like it, that there were elements of it, because I know for a fact that extreme right people and extreme right groups did take part in some of the events of 68 and were used by special branch, etc. The problem is, as identified by Laurie, this country is so secret, we do not know. There are no files, no one's come forward. We just do not have the situation that was in Europe in the 1990s, where each country carried out a pretty extensive inquiry into their own stay behind, Gladio, strategy of tension, etc. It's never taken place here, which indicates to me there is something that they are hiding. I'm writing a book about it at the moment, and I know something of it. But compared to other countries, we are in the dark. Some strange things did take place. GB75, I think you're referring to all the kind of intelligence, private armies, etc. They really didn't get off the ground. And in fact, I think most of them were designed purely as propaganda instruments. Yeah. They were never intended to do anything. They were intended to create a kind of fear, an idea that something might happen. And they were intended to provoke the government into doing something, or in the case of Wilson, bring it down. And that didn't happen. But it's very clear that there was a lot going on. And again, there's still things that we don't know about. One, to come back to something I think was Nigel was talking about, one of the things that the British are very good at, intelligence, is what's known as disruptive action, which is to divide groups. This is one of the key things they do abroad, and they probably did here, which is to sow seeds of discontent within organizations, to give the illusion that they've been infiltrated, that key people are acting as agents. And they use the press a lot for this. You know, there's 25 officers in MI6. What do they do? Well, some of them are spreading disinformation in newspapers abroad. And they managed to destroy a couple of terrorist groups in the 1980s by planting information in the press with this idea that groups were fighting each other and that members had talked or were talking to the security services and all that kind of stuff. So they're perfectly capable of doing those kind of things.
Okay, thanks. Anne Field has indicated that she'd like to make some points about the left-wing press. Anne Field, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much, Granville. Just a short couple of points. But briefly to say, I remember how difficult it was to try to raise support for the Shrewsbury pickets in 1972 and then 73. Because people's minds were so poisoned by this whole thing of violence and what have you. And it was in total contrast to the way in which people responded to, for example, the imprisonment of the Dockers in the July. The Shrewsbury picket business started in the September. And I believe that the establishment were very clear that 3 months on from the successful release, the whole campaign to release the Dockers, 3 months later, the establishment decided to hit back and make an example. Oh. So that's the context for me as a young trade unionist at the time, and Politico, if you like, a member of the Communist Party as I became. But I want to make a quick point about the left-wing press. I think we've all got our favourite socialist newspapers and progressive newspapers, and there are always difficulties. There's rivalries, political differences, and so on. But it is for us to defend our left-wing and progressive press and to make it work. and to make it work for us. And I'm sorry to hear about Eileen's experience, and I hope that the movement is able to produce a better result for her, although I regularly read about the Shrewsbury pickets in the Morning Star. However, I just want to say that during the Wapping dispute in 1986, a letter was published in the Morning Star 10 days after the dispute started. And this was the letter that the company's solicitor, Farrars, the Queen's solicitor, had advised the company how best to get rid of an entire unionised workforce by deliberately provoking a dispute and then sacking people, and sacking them literally overnight and at a weekend. And that's exactly what happened. It was sent, it was leaked from the solicitor, and it was sent to a national newspaper, which refused to publish it. However, an enterprising and progressive member of the NUJ at the Mirror passed it to Mick Costello at the Morning Star. And of course, the Morning Star published it. And we were forever grateful to the Morning Star after that. So we have to protect our left-wing press and to make sure that workers are able to have access to print and to online journalism. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. Can I just give a quick plug? Anne Field has been very actively involved with the Wapping archive, the News International Dispute Archive. And the film has just come out, which I really do recommend, which is called Wapping, the Worker's Story. And you can find details of that in Media North. Now,
can I just say one thing, please?
Yes, of course, Eileen.
Okay. Yes, Anne, I have to come back to you because the Morning Star has actually been absolutely excellent on Shrewsbury. And I'm sorry if people got the wrong idea. I wanted to correct that.
Okay, thanks, Eileen. Okay. I must admit, I thought you were being critical of that as well as The Guardian, but thank you for making that point. Now, we're coming towards the end, so I'm going to ask in reverse order if, Laurie, you'd like to make any final points you want to in this session.
Yeah, I think what we can see happening in the SNP at the moment is worth some consideration. I think the crisis of the imperial state in Britain is still unresolved. It will continue. I don't believe for a second that there's any chance of it going away. The grievances and injustices are so considerable that take place that I think there's every reason to be both somewhat concerned about what further trough of despond we may have to go through, but that I believe that the Shrewsbury campaign will win out. I believe the Orgreef campaign will win out, and I believe that the women who have brought the appalling behaviour of the Metropolitan Police to some kind of crescendo, they'll win out. I think that the forthcoming report on the Daniel Morgan murder will be extremely interesting. It may not give the family everything they want, but it certainly will clarify a good number of very profound questions about the levels of corruption in the Metropolitan Police. I believe that Wapping is another matter that simply will not go away. And I think there's every reason to believe that persistence, integrity, and evidence really will win out, perhaps not while I'm still alive, but...
Don't be so gloomy.
...sometime afterwards.
Thanks, Laurie. Eileen, any last points you want to make, please?
Just to say that I'm absolutely optimistic that the Pickett's case will succeed. I think the evidence is extremely strong. I think the judges will find in favour of the Pickett's. And I cannot express to you how relieved and how pleased those pickets will be after 47 years. And I, for one, admire them. They've stuck to the guns and they've never given up. Yeah. And that in itself has got to be admired. That's all I have to say.
Absolutely.
Thank you for that, Eileen. Steve, any last words?
I think we do live in dark times and they're probably going to get darker. However, I think we have to remain very optimistic. And as the advice that was given to Eileen, you just have to keep digging and digging and digging. And realize some of this stuff takes a very, very long time. Some of the things I've been interested in and others have been interested in had no response from the media 20, 30 years ago, but now it has. And you just have to hang in there. I would say you still need the mainstream press. And for those doing campaigning, I think my advice was cultivate certain journalists. Get to know them. There are some really good journalists working on some bad newspapers, but if they think the story is good enough and if you can supply them with stuff, they will run things. And that's the same, I think, with local newspapers. You know, 90% of the material that appears in a lot of newspapers is pure PR. So I write my own press releases. I'm appalled to discover that they are printed without any alteration in newspapers. Even including my own quotes for myself. But you can get to use the press, and I think it's the same with MPs. There aren't as many campaigning MPs as there used to be, but there are some, and you need to cultivate them. That takes a long time as well, but you can be done. And I would also suggest, as a person who loves print, maybe that's not the right format anymore, and maybe it's to do with small films, podcasts, and all those kind of things, because there is a good audience and market for documentaries. And given the technology that is easy accessible, I would like to see more documentaries done by amateurs about some of these subjects. So I remain optimistic.
Good. Well, thank you, Steve. And thank all of you. Just one last plug. Media North, if you don't know about it and you want to get it, go to Google it and you'll go to the website. And if you want to receive copies and emails about the work we do, go to cpbfnorth@outlook.com. Can I thank you all for taking part? I hope you found it informative. I found it riveting and great speakers. And can I thank you all? And thank Scott, the working group Momentum, for doing the technical work without which this would not have happened, folks. Thanks ever so much. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Good night.